There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Here's an ad I didn't think I'd be recording. Today's Shut Up, Evan is sponsored by Clone a Willy, the at-home penis molding kit. Yes, you heard that right. The original Clone a Willy lets you create a homemade dildo out of 100% platinum cure metal grade silicone. Whether you want to replicate your penis or the penis of someone you love, or even the penis of someone you hate, Clone a Willy is a fun, body safe penis making kit available in 9 colors. That's right, 9, including light skin, dark skin, and even neon purple, because why not? And since we're all about gender equality, the brand also offers kits for cloning other body parts. I'd say the name, but this is a family-friendly podcast-ish. To learn more about how Clone a Willy works and to purchase your very own, head to cloneawilly.com and use promo code SHUTUPEVAN for 20% off your order. That's promo code SHUTUPEVAN. Can I just ask?
Shut up, Evan.
I'm curious.
Could you shut up, Evan?
One thing I was thinking about.
Shut up, Evan.
So there are some rumors out there.
Evan, shut up.
Is it okay if I just ask?
Shut up, Evan.
Okay, but can I just?
Shut up, Evan.
I didn't even say anything. Welcome back to Shut Up, Evan. I'm, as you probably know, Evan Ross Katz. I'm joined once again by my co-host and friend, Sean Ross. Sean, hi.
Hello.
As Lady Gaga said at the 2018 MTV Movie and TV Awards, Happy Pride Month.
Happy Pride Month.
Did she?
Yeah, she declared it. And from that day forward, it continued the tradition of rainbows and celebrations of what it means to be LGBTQ+.
Yeah, she really did invent pride in a lot of ways.
There were prides before her, but I feel like it was a turning point. Although one could argue that things have really gone downhill since that declaration by way of LGBTQ+ rights and advancements in collective society's acceptance of us and our people. But that is a conversation for another day.
No correlation to Joker Folie à Deux.
I mean, one could make one. But quickly, how is your Pride Month going? Are you feeling the pride?
Honestly, I can't believe it's June, and am I feeling the pride? Like, not yet, but I'm ready. I only have just started noticing the flags, and I'm like, oh my God, it's June. But I'm ready. I'm ready for pride.
I'm surprised we don't have like a pop star with the ready for pride kind of like anthem. I'm surprised we don't have more pop stars creating songs specifically centered around pride. Like, obviously we have gay anthems and whatnot and gay bops and bops that are made for gays. Like, these all exist, but I would love like a pride anthem.
Someone call Mariah Carey.
Get her on the line. You know, she's doing LA Pride very soon, so she could, you know, debut her pride anthem featuring Megan Thee Stallion, even, because she's co-headlining with Megan Thee Stallion. I'm riffing here, but like, I feel like that could be a hit.
All I want for Pride is finish the sentence.
And then you get lots of features from LGBTQ+ artists who come on and finish each sentence throughout the song. Who is the LGBTQ artist you would most want to see featured on Mariah Carey featuring Megan Thee Stallion's song?
JoJo Siwa.
Yeah.
Or G Flip.
Important. I'm going to go for Brandi Carlile, but I like the idea of like Brandi Carlile and JoJo Siwa on the same track.
I've got my eyes on Brandi Carlile right now, because this weekend is the Brandi Carlile, Joni Mitchell performances in Washington State.
Wow.
And I didn't get tickets.
Not good.
I would have been there if I got tickets.
I was going to say unexpected, but like not that unexpected when you really think about it.
Oh, no. Brandi Carlile will hitch her cart to any horse.
And listen, I get it. I get why. I'm in the buggy behind, kind of like following along. But we are not here today to explicitly talk about Pride. However, I can make a seamless transition here in that we're here today because this past week, a week ago today, was the 25th anniversary of the beloved series Sex and the City. And how I'm going to connect these two topics is that when it was leaked, when the news leaked that Kim Cattrall would be returning for a cameo on And Just Like That, a day later, Kim Cattrall posted the news on her Instagram in an image that's like not properly squared. Like she didn't get the image. It was just one of those things that bothered me.
How was the quality of the image?
It was very much giving screenshot over screenshot.
Okay, yeah.
It was giving like someone sent her a screenshot of the Variety article and Kim screenshotted it and then went to sort of like, what's it called when you like, oh, crop. Yeah, mm-hmm. She went to crop the image and then like didn't quite realize that there's a function that can center it for you. Mm. I kind of at the same time, as much as I'm criticizing it here, I do sort of appreciate that like that approach to social media, the imperfections, if you will. So anyway, but Kim posted the news and the caption was Happy Pride.
Oh.
So there you go.
I'm surprised she posted it because
yeah,
isn't this sort of thing supposed to be a secret?
Listen, conversation for another day and conversation for off the pod. But yes, it was supposed to be a secret. And it's surprising because no one else has acknowledged it from inside the show except for Kim. But can you believe it? I can. But it is Pride Month and it is the 25th anniversary of Sex and the City. And those two things do go hand in hand. And so as such, I was like, oh, Sean, let's discuss the pilot episode of Sex and the City. And interestingly, and this happens with you and I often, and sometimes it's you and sometimes it's me, where this beloved thing for one of us, the other person has never experienced. And so I just got to ask you, This is a very, very popular show. You are a gay man with a proclivity for popular culture. How have you gone this long? I was going to say dodging the bullet. I mean, but like, no, it's not a bullet. Dodging the, I don't know, the thing that it's hard to dodge. Sex and the City.
It's true. It's hard. I mean, for you, you never watched Game of Thrones, right?
True.
Similar. Well, Game of Thrones isn't really gay. It's gay-ish, but not gay. Not explicitly gay in the way that Sex and the City is gay.
Or explicitly gay in the way that the recent Beauty and the Beast movie is.
Beauty and the Beast is gay?
Yeah, do you know about the explicitly gay moment? Did you know about this?
The one with Emma Watson?
Yes.
I watched it.
It was touted by Disney as having an explicitly gay moment.
Between who? Clogsworth and somebody?
Between Josh Gad's character and Gaston, I believe.
Oh my God.
Beauty and the Beast director Bill Condon sparked a major conversation this week when he said Josh Gad's character LeFou has Disney's first, quote, exclusively gay moment in the film.
I don't know enough about this to speak about this, but anyway, when you said gay in Game of Thrones, head went to the Beauty and the Beast. If you don't know, Google it. They literally called it a, quote, unquote, explicitly gay moment. And it's been spoofed recently on the other two.
Okay, I'll have to rewatch that movie. How did I avoid Sex and the City? Well, I wasn't going out of my way to avoid Sex and the City, but it premiered in 1998.
Yes.
Right? That 25 years? Yeah, doing the math. And it wasn't on in my house. I was like a child. I was a child at home and my parents weren't watching it. It's also a little complicated because obviously I'm Canadian. And so HBO doesn't exist here in the way that it exists in the United States. So another network has to pick it up. I don't know for sure, but I feel like it was on like a Showtime, something a little seedier up here. And so that wasn't regular viewing in my household. That was where I would watch like Queer as Folk in the basement alone in the dark. And so don't quote me on this, that it was on that channel, but it was that sort of a situation where it wasn't on like a mainstream channel that people just had. And certainly my parents weren't watching it. And so if I wasn't being exposed to it through my parents, I just wasn't going to be interested. And so I knew about it because it was just in the zeitgeist and Sarah Jessica Parker was on the talk shows and I was a talk show watcher. But it didn't really pique my interest. Of course, as I got older, it was impossible to avoid. And I had dipped my toe in a few times. You did this great carousel post of guest stars, and two of those are two of my favorite people, which are Alanis Morissette and Jerry Halliwell. Very 1998.
Very.
Of course, they came much later in the show, but I did seek out those episodes. So I saw those, and I saw an episode where somebody wanted to pee on Carrie. Carrie instead suggested pouring hot tea, warm tea, on her leg. And I think I saw one more episode, just sort of like somebody put it on, right? And at that point, there's just so much. Once a show gets like three seasons deep, it's hard to get me to watch it because,
yes,
you know, I'm not you. I'm not you going into Survivor watching 40 seasons in 2020. Like, that's just not my style. So I just sort of like went, okay, I missed the boat on this. I'll let it be what it is. And so there's unavoidable aspects of the show that I've picked up, but I really don't know that much about it.
So top level, watching this pilot episode, what are your thoughts?
Okay, well, I would say surprised. There were some things that surprised me. First of all, I loved the 90s nostalgia, which is actually quite funny because the show opens with Carrie talking about how the good old days are gone in New York City, right? And here I had just been watching it being like, wow, the good old days of New York City. And so that's like sort of a funny little thing that happens when you watch these old shows. And then I was surprised at how kind of normal everybody was. I think I enjoyed it overall. Didn't know they were half-hour episodes. Thought I was getting myself into an hour-long drama. So that was refreshing. Love a half-hour episode. And I don't know. The pilot episode, I think for me, it was like, felt like it was setting up the sort of manifesto of Carrie Bradshaw and setting the table for what's to come. But some things really surprised me.
So just to give a little setup, this episode was shot kind of like a pilot presentation. I don't know if that's the word that they would use, but basically it was shot in an effort to show the network, this is what this show will be. And that's why you get a lot of details in this episode, namely Carrie's hair and her apartment, which are totally different come episode two.
Oh.
Also, famously, Sarah Jessica, I don't want to say has like disavowed this episode, but she's spoken in several interviews, you know, much later on about the fact that like she wasn't so sure about whether or not she wanted to be a part of this show after filming the pilot. You know, she had a great film and theater career at the time, and I don't think the pilot, it doesn't really give you a sense of where the series is going to go. And so I don't think she was incredibly drawn to it. I've seen some quotes of her like outright disparaging it. But then when I like clicked on the link to it, it took me into the Wayback Machine. And then it was like a website called like 365 Gay. And I just was like, this could be a fever dream. I don't know if I trust it. But I would be interested, like I would love a DVD commentary from Darren Starr, the writer, Susan Seidelman, the director, and SJ talking about this pilot, because I'm really curious what their thoughts are 25 years later. But as I mentioned, it is written by Darren Starr, who is credited as the creator of the show. It's directed by Susan Seidelman of Desperately Seeking Susan and She-Devil fame.
Great.
Yeah, that is a good pedigree, if you will.
Yeah.
The Hollywood Reporter called the pilot, quote, flat, bitter, and flaccid, while the New York Times called it, quote, fresh and funny. But I really do think it's the Los Angeles Times that had the best sense and sort of grasp on what the show was. They said, quote, it is shamelessly superficial as the crowd it memorializes, but so sophisticated in its approach to shallowness that it's also great fun. And that's one thing I really do think about Sex and the City season one, especially, it's fun. And I will say, Sean, having you just watched Buffy the Vampire Slayer, mm-hmm. I think there are a lot of similarities between Buffy season one and Sex and the City season one as sort of being more or less like a test drive as to what the show grows to become. I'm really fond of the first season of Sex and the City. But when we're talking about Sex and the City as like the institution, as like this, you know, culturally significant piece of media, those moments are not so much present in season one. I think the show, especially with its regard as like sort of this historic piece of fashion media, that really doesn't kick off until season two. So we open with this like 4-minute sequence where we meet, I believe their names are Elizabeth and Tim. And I'm wondering, you know, we who watched this episode, we know where it's going. Did you have a sense that these were two characters that were going to be present on the show?
I thought two different things. I thought, one, this is a fictionalized version of Carrie Bradshaw and she's writing about herself. And so I thought she was giving us backstory about herself, that maybe she moved from somewhere in the United States. She's just sort of like changed the location. I thought this was going to be her origin story, and I think I would have preferred that. Then she's, it turns out this English girl is talking to Carrie Bradshaw and telling her this, her story. And I'm like, okay, so they're friends. She's going to be one of the friends. There's a fifth Beatle, you know? And no, I was going to ask you, does this English girl appear in a future episode?
Never comes back.
Oh, what a shame.
But you know, again, to make a parallel with Buffy, there's that character Jesse, who's Willow and Xander's best friend in the pilot episode, who is never seen or referred to again. I mean, granted, he dies and he's becomes a vampire, but nonetheless, it's sort of just like there's this character that you're introduced to that you're like, think that you need to get situated with, and then all of a sudden, out of mind, out of sight. No, she's never seen or referred to again. But I will say it is a trope that lasts throughout the series, where like you'll meet an old friend of Carrie's for an episode, and then all of a sudden, like we never hear from them again, and they're never mentioned. First of all, what a striking first image of Carrie.
Yeah,
the cigarette, and you know, this has become sort of Carrie Bradshaw lore. You know, like her history with cigarettes. You know, famously, she's photographed on the cover of New York Magazine, the Single and Fabulous question mark episode. Again, I know this is stuff you don't know, but people listening will. Cigarettes are a huge part of the show, and on just. In and just like that, when she lights up a cigarette, which is the first time she does it in many, many years, it's seen as a sort of like Carrie is like returning to her proper form. You know, like the old Carrie is back. And you can really track, she quits smoking cigarettes. I believe it's in season 3 or 4. It's the first or second, I don't want to give too many spoilers in case you watch it. But anyway, she's got a long history with cigarettes. I just love that image because, again, it's 1998. I just don't think you got a lot of leading lady figures just so brazenly. I don't know. I guess you it's not like you hadn't seen women smoking on in film or television. It's not that. There's just, I don't know. There's something I find so striking about watching this, like, this character with a cigarette. It feels dangerous.
Carrie walked so Mare could run.
Truly. Truly.
And I loved at that. I loved at the club Chaos. Which, by the way, I have another question: is Chaos a staple location?
No, but like one of Sex and the City's things is that it creates sort of these hyper realistic clubs that I'm sure are based off of clubs that the writers went to at that time.
I did love that they had cigarette girls.
Yes,
they had staff walking around selling cigarettes.
Yes,
the good old days really are gone.
They are. I mean, as Carrie says, she says, "Welcome to the age of uninnocence. No one has breakfast at Tiffany's and no one has affairs to remember." It's just a great introduction to Carrie and setting up the series. And then we get this shot of her. As I said, this is only her apartment in the pilot, but it's like you get the coffee shop and the camera just sort of pans in and her window's right outside the coffee shop light. And she's just typing away on what is a computer that will stick around only for the pilot episode. and then soon after, we're introduced to our three other lead characters. So first up, we have Miranda. And again, it's like crazy to me that you're like meeting these women for the first time, but I love it. So first up, we have Miranda Hobbs Esquire. Her lower third is corporate lawyer and unmarried woman. She's eating a hot bar salad with boneless wings.
Oh my God.
I have a friend. Who'd always gone out with extremely sexy guys and just had a good time. One day, she woke up and she was 41. She couldn't get any more dates. She had a complete physical breakdown, couldn't hold on to her job, and had to move back to Wisconsin to live with her mother.
What was your reaction to the hot bar salad with the boneless chicken wings?
This is the thing. She's holding the wings in a pair of tongs at the camera. I thought they were bone-in wings. Did they have boneless wings in the 90s? Weren't those just called chicken fingers?
I don't know. It's funny you say this. I took a screenshot of the episode and sent the image to Billy. And I was like, what do you call these? Because I was like, I don't know how you refer to something like this.
I saw a bone. I think that there were bone in, which was wild. I specifically was like, this is the craziest salad I've ever seen. It's a salad, a very 90s salad. You remember these like iceberg lettuce and like shaved carrot salads?
It's diplomatic to call it a salad. It's just greenery.
Yeah. And then on top of it, two chicken wings for some protein.
And then she's sitting in the park with a disposable fork, just sort of like, you know, doing that thing where you just like, you know, put your salad in the, put your fork in the salad and it's like, hope something sticks.
Yeah.
If we were to go down this road, is she picking up the wings with her hand or like,
for sure.
You know, like in theory, I mean, like this is maybe grotesque, but like you could stick the fork into the chicken wing.
Yeah. But you don't have the leverage to pull the meat off, right? You would need the knife.
Yeah. Yeah. Just a very, very odd decision and incredibly un-Miranda. Not just the chicken wing, but just Miranda getting lunch at a hot bar. I mean, you do you, obviously, but like that was a surprising choice. I feel like Miranda, the Miranda I know, would look down on people that get lunch at the hot bar. But who's to know? Who's to say? Then we are introduced to Charlotte York, art dealer, unmarried woman.
Most men are threatened by successful women. If you want to get these guys, you have to keep your mouth shut and play by the rules.
What was your initial reaction to Charlotte? I feel like she has the least significant story in this episode.
Yeah, well, I have to say, just with regards to Miranda and Charlotte in particular, I was kind of surprised at how normal both of them were, in the sense that they just kind of seemed like regular people. And the reason that's surprising is because, of course, I know that everybody asks people, are you the Miranda? Are you the Charlotte? Are you the Samantha? Are you the Carrie? And so in order to have those kinds of personas, you think they have to be like almost caricatures, right? And I didn't get caricature from virtually anyone except maybe Samantha. And even then, there's some nuance in this episode.
Yeah, it's like muted caricature.
Yeah. And so Charlotte, like, seems like a nice girl. Traditional.
Deals art. Tell me this, though. I mean, like, you are a person who's on the internet. Do you have any sense of these women from, like, meme culture?
Charlotte, no. Of course, I've seen Miranda around.
But are there any, like, specific memes that you're like... Because when I think of Miranda, there's one that goes around that perhaps you've seen, and it's her the morning after a heavy night of drinking, and she's like pressed up against the wall, and the subtitle reads, "The next morning, Miranda woke up with the worst hangover of her life." And that is very popular within our community. It's, you know, just it's relatable.
It's certainly possible. I've seen it. But
okay, but there's no immediate, like, I'm thinking of, like, you know, eating the Chinese food out of the trash, not something you're familiar with.
No.
Putting the braces, putting on the goggles after the eye surgery. Like, none of these images are pinging.
No. If you showed me them, I might recognize them. But
okay, curious. No. But you are picking up on something that I think is really significant here, which is that there's, like, these shades of who the characters become. Like, the archetypes are all in place in this episode, but the, like, the iconography has not yet clicked in. Mm-hmm. Everyone is sort of being a version of who they go on to become, which is not uncommon in a pilot episode. I will say, though, like, this episode is very much a departure from the Carrie that we will see in future episodes. There's, like, a grittiness to Carrie in this pilot episode. I mean, the moment I always think about, and I think at the time that I first watched this, the moment that was like really stuck with me was when she's at the restaurant with Stanford, she sees her ex-boyfriend, she goes over there talking, she grabs his cigarette, smokes it, and then right before she leaves, she like hands it back to him. And it's something I like remember in my early 20s, like replicating with friends, like, you know, when we would be at bars and whatnot. And anyway, but there's just something about Carrie that I think the Carrie that is to come, I feel like there's like the Carrie of the pilot and the Carrie of the rest of the series. And I feel like the Carrie of the pilot is someone that the Carrie of the series would like meet for an episode and have a storyline with. There's like, there's this diverging, because there's just a softer, I don't want to call Carrie soft, because that's not really Carrie either. But again, just that grittiness of that quality about her is not present after this first episode.
That's too bad, because I really liked that. I was really surprised by Carrie's character in the way that she acted and the way that she carried herself with this very like, fuck you, I'm doing my own thing. I'm my own person. I'm going to carry myself the way I want to. And for example, when she, you know, leaves her hookup basically and goes out on the street, all of her stuff spills out of her purse and she meets Mr. Big, who that's somebody I'm familiar with. And just sort of like her attitude in that whole scene, I really, really liked. I thought it was refreshing, and it made sense with the voiceovers that I was hearing.
Also here, yes, there's just this undeniable like ballsiness about Carrie. And that doesn't entirely go away, but it's funny watching the trailer for season 2 of And Just Like That and comparing that Carrie to the Carrie of this episode and being like, that I'm supposed to understand those to be the same character, but they feel like two women that exist in completely different universes. But I kind of think that that's in some ways fun to be like, wow, this is the journey of this character. And then we meet Samantha Jones, public relations executive, unmarried woman.
Look, if you're a successful saleswoman in this city, you have two choices. You can bang your head against the wall and try and find a relationship, or you can say screw it and just go out and have sex like a man.
You mean with dildos?
No, I mean without feeling.
What was your initial reaction to Samantha, who I think has gone on in the lore of this show to become the show's most iconic character?
Yeah, I am very familiar with the idea of Samantha Jones, so I had a lot of expectations going in, and I think it was more or less, I could see what I was expecting to see in Samantha. And what really surprised me about Samantha, and sorry, maybe I'm jumping ahead here, is that sort of like look on her face while she's hooking up.
Let's talk about that look.
Can I go there?
Yeah.
Because you have this whole bravado going on through the whole episode that, she will have sex like a man. That's sort of like what they're talking about all episode, is like, can women have sex like men? Which means no strings attached. We're not going to get involved. We don't care. One and done, right? And then so she goes back to this guy's apartment after he's ditched Charlotte, essentially. And he's like, hey, I need you to leave before morning. And she's like, great. And then there's this zoom in on her face. And I thought this was the most powerful moment of the episode, is sort of like her eye acting, where you can see some crack in the veneer and that she feels hurt or hollow in some way. Or am I reading it wrong? And is that some kind of moment of pleasure that I'm like, but I don't think I'm reading it wrong.
No, and I love that you caught that moment. And I think it's, I'd like to believe it's purposefully ambiguous, but I feel like Samantha fulfills the brief of the episode a lot better than Carrie, because Carrie, the character, is asking this question, like, can women have sex like a man? And so Carrie tries it out and then ultimately discovers that she can't. And what I love about the Samantha plotline, because Samantha's very much earlier in the episode, like, absolutely, like, this is the best it's ever been for women in New York right now. We should be having sex like men. And that ambiguity with Samantha, where she's able to do it and she's going to keep doing it. Whereas, like, Carrie makes this decision that it's not for her. Samantha, it is for her, but in that sort of that facial reaction, you're not sure if it's actually fulfilling her. And I think there's so much more nuance in that Samantha moment than Carrie, who, like, is just very conclusive about the fact that, like, she thought she could do this, but she sees him with another woman. Whereas I feel like Samantha, in a moment like that, would, as she did rather, grabs, you know, she gets rejected by Big, finds another man, but is left uncertain. And I guess the question too is, it's like, I would love to have seen Samantha's walk home, or her cab ride home rather, just because I feel like there's, Samantha's the character that you leave this episode wondering, where will we go from here? Who is this person? What are her stories left to tell? I think.
So I have a question for you. How do you feel about this then? Because I personally, while I found that moment interesting, probably the most interesting moment of the pilot, I was a little bit let down by it, because I really liked this conceit of women trying to have sex like men. And then in the end, it's sort of like, no, that's, we actually can't. And I felt like that was like a little bit taking two steps back in a way. And then pair that with like the unmarried woman subtitles. Like it was just a little bit, I see the progress you're going for, but your conclusion is not getting us there.
Yeah. And this is something that I think Sex and the City waffles on, in that like you'll see some episodes and you'll be like, oh my God, I can't believe they were talking about this thing then. I mean, I think, for instance, minor spoiler, sorry, Sean, but like in season 4, Miranda gets an abortion. And when I go back and I watch that episode now, I'm like, this is so profound in the nuance of how all 4 of the characters are responding to the abortion. And I love that Miranda like is admitting to the group that she's going to have an abortion, and Carrie's reaction is like, oh yeah, I've had an abortion. And Samantha's is like, I've had 3. I just think that frankness around something that on any other show would be like the big reveal, Sex and the City is able to like normalize it and then like, and then go a step further and be like, you've had 1, I've had 3, which I think is like, I don't want to use the word progressive, but I just think is like a great way in which the show was able to like do something that other shows were not. But then you have episodes like this one where it's sort of like they bring about this really interesting thesis, and then ultimately they conclude, they like make a very clear conclusion where it's like women can't have sex like men, where I think a later episode might have given you different answers to the question, where one of them actually might have found fulfillment. Or, you know, if I were to like sort of Sex and the City-ify this, it would be that one of the women is on this journey of like, can I have sex like a man? And it would be the man who cops feelings for her and she has to like get rid of him. I feel like Sex and the City is really good at sort of like spinning the thing where it's like, you think you want this thing and it's going to bring about sort of like, not gender equality, but sort of like, you know, even the score rather. But then you realize that like men have their own hangups. They're just different hangups than the ones you thought. That to me is sort of how I like to think about the show, which is why like I want you to watch more Sex and the City.
Right.
And I hope you will. I also wanted to just point out one of the other great moments I love, when Carrie is having sex with Kurt. You get this shot where like the camera starts on the floor and there's like the clothes strewn everywhere. Carrie's moaning. And then when it finally gets to Carrie's face, it appears as though she's dismounting him. And I'm like, oh my God, like another one of these shows that like makes sex seem like this act where like you finish and then like you get off and then you're both lying next to each other. But then you get this sort of like reveal that Kurt is going down on her. And I love that. I feel like there's something way sexier about someone going down on someone and way like more risque on television, going down on someone as opposed to sex, because sex has become this sort of like very robotic act in a lot of movies and so unrealistic, where it's like the guy pulls out, then like gets right up and you're like, wait a minute, like where's the condom, or like is his dick still hard? There's all these questions. I feel like this show is, and this is continues to be a thing, but the show is really good at like depicting a lot of the different kinds of sex that people have and the different ways they have sex.
Yeah. I also have to say, aside from the frame on Samantha's eyes while she's at her little hookup, the other frame that stuck with me was when Carrie pulls the blanket off of Kurt. And I think that, and we're sort of stuck with Kurt in bed in that moment. And I feel like if I had been watching this in 1998, I would have been watching and rewatching and rewatching that scene.
But then you get that little sliver of his boxer, because there's the illusion that he's naked. Yeah.
Oh, see, I thought you didn't.
No, you do, unfortunately. It's like in the final frame, in the bottom right hand of the corner. I hate that I know this, because I love that shot of sort of thinking, like, at any moment, if the camera just dips a little lower, we're getting pubes, which we don't get, but we also, yeah, you get that frame. Or if it's not a boxer, something is covering him that's not the sheet.
Okay.
I'm sorry to say. But Kurt's cute.
Kurt's so cute. Is Kurt a recurring character?
No. So one of the tropes of Sex and the City is you'll never see any man more than once, save for the P guy, John Slattery, whose episode, you've seen one of his episodes. Okay. He stays around for 2 episodes. And then there are a few other moments, and of course there are her boyfriends, but this show is very disposable with its men, which is another unique trope of the show that I absolutely love. Now, before we sort of wrap things up, let's just touch down briefly on Mr. Big. We do get the first reference to him being called Mr. Big. As I was watching it and Carrie refers to him as that to Samantha, I was like, where is this coming from? Like, I've never understood the name, but in that moment I was like, you go back and watch this episode and think there's going to be some origin to the name, but like, there's not. And there's really, it's not as though like they slept together and he had a huge cock and she's like, oh, I'm going to call him Mr. Big from now on. That's not like it at all. They barely know one another. But let me just ask, like, when I go back and rewatch this episode, I am struck by how not sexy Big is to me. And I feel like there was a time that you would say that and people would be like, oh, what are you talking about? But I feel like in 2023, that's a more normalized opinion. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, he didn't really do anything for me. It's not that he's not good looking. I think he's fine. I was surprised that this is the Mr. Big that I've heard so much about. And I mean, he must have an interesting character developed for him over the years if he's sort of like built up in the lore in this way that I know so much about who he is. So I was a little surprised that, one, he gets a nickname out of nowhere. That's part of the reason I rewatched the episode, because I was like, I missed where Big comes from, because that seems kind of important. Didn't miss it, wasn't there. And then I think that there's potential for him. Like, I will say I really loved that ending line of, have you ever been in love? And he says, abso-fucking-lutely.
Have you ever been in love?
Abso-fucking-lutely.
I think that was, like, really great. That was a great way to end. And so I'm intrigued by him. Am I, like, hot for him? No.
But at the time, the media narrative was really spun out to be like that, like, Big is the best a woman could ever do. It's like, he's sexy, he's wealthy, he's successful, he's charming. And I look back on it now and I'm like, there are so many better men present throughout the series. Thank God he died.
Oh, spoiler.
That's my reaction. So overall, are you compelled, having watched this episode, to watch more? Because I will say, sorry to ask a question over a question, or no, sorry to keep talking after a question. Can you believe it? But like, even the next episode, I feel like is an evolution for the show. And then obviously, as I mentioned, season two, it really takes off. But like, do you feel the inclination to try more?
Yeah, I mean, I'll definitely try more at this point. I watched a pilot twice in like 12 hours. So I do feel some duty to watch more to see where this goes. Now you've got me intrigued and you're doing the same thing that you did to me with Buffy, kind of tricking me into watching the whole thing by being like, well, season one is sort of like an experiment. If you really have to see a season two to get into it. And then by the time you're that deep in, you're like, well, I better watch the rest. So I see what's happening here and I'm not opposed to it. So I'm willing to watch some more. I have to say that the surprise for me that it's like a 26-minute episode, that's big news for me, because mm-hmm. like that's bite-sized. I can put it on while I'm eating and move on to the next thing in my life.
I think we should touch down later this season of Shut Up, Evan, and have me choose for you one of my favorite episodes, so that like we can sort of go from Sean's first time to Sean being shown what I consider to be like the iconography of Sex and the City. I would be really curious to have that juxtaposition from you, having like seen only a handful of episodes, because like when the show is full throttle, like there are a few shows that go as fast. Like it just, it has a way. Also, I want to say too, the writing of the show, one of the things it's really, really known for, that is not really so much present in this episode. There are some lines that like, are lining, but like not really going anywhere. Carrie, when they enter Club Chaos, says, Friday night at Chaos, it was just like that bar in Cheers, where everyone knows your name, except here, they were likely to forget it 5 minutes later. And it's like, well, not everyone knows everyone's name at the club. Like I get, I like the written line, like I get what we were doing here, but like it needs to be grounded somehow. So yeah, I feel like it's just like the dots of the show were there. Were they yet connecting? Not so much, but like they were like beautifully rendered dots. That's how I feel about this episode. One other thing I just wanted to mention, Carrie outside Club Chaos says that she might have to do the unspeakable walk home. So I just want to point out the fact that Carrie, Club Chaos, is located on West Broadway and Broome, we're told. Carrie lives on 73rd and 2nd Street. I Google mapped this ahead of time. That is a 1 hour and 29 minute walk. And she says that it's like just before dawn. So like we're late in the night here. And no doubt she's in heels. It's mm-hmm. like, girl, get a cab.
Well, she couldn't get one. Wasn't that the point?
Oh, did I miss that?
She couldn't get a cab.
Wait, this would be me being like, I thought I like picked up on this crazy thing and I'm like on Google Maps. Meanwhile, it's like, it's all laid out there.
But like, doesn't the train run all night?
I was just going to say, girl, get on the subway.
Yeah.
Let's think. West Broadway and Broome. She can walk over to the city. Oh, yeah, she's set. She can get a train from there. Girl, get on the train. But I do want to say, like, it does harken back to, you know, we live in this world of Ubers and Lyfts, and there was a time where you had to hail a taxi, and you could be in an area where that wasn't going to happen. And it reminds me, I mean, I don't have that experience so much. I mean, I did come here in the age of taxis, but I was living in Manhattan, but like I do remember the days of MapQuest and family vacations and like my dad being like, I will not pull over and ask for directions.
But do you feel like the good old days are gone?
I do. I mean, like, obviously like everything's easier now, but there was something to be said about like the grit, right? Yeah. To bring it all back. I miss the grit. Okay, Sean, two last questions. Are you a Carrie, a Miranda, a Samantha, a Charlotte, a Skipper, a Stanford, a Big?
Wow.
Do we need a fourth guy? Who's the guy she fucks?
Kurt.
Okay, so are you a Big, a Kurt, a Stanford, a Skipper, a Charlotte, a Carrie, a Samantha, a Miranda?
I probably wish that I was a Kurt. And it sounds bold to say that I'm a Samantha because I feel like that represents so much that I don't understand. But in this episode, I feel like I'm a Samantha because that sort of like front that you put up, but you know, I think we're all a little bit Samantha in the pilot episode, no?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Especially like gay men.
I identify as an Elizabeth. I'm an outlier here.
Tori, who's Elizabeth?
She comes at the beginning of the episode for those 3 minutes.
Oh, the English girl.
You say English. She is decidedly Australian, despite the fact that she identifies as English in this episode. That accent was wild. Really crazy. Okay, so tell me this much to wrap up on. If I know you mentioned that maybe I got you intrigued, but say like we weren't having this conversation on the podcast today. You just watched this pilot episode. Is this a show that you think you would continue watching having just watched this pilot?
In 1998 or today?
Give me 1998. The good old days.
For sure. Oh my God, I had nothing to do. Are you joking?
Okay.
I would be in my calendar.
Well, let me tell you, if and when you stay with this show, you will be treated to a number of our faves. Sarah Michelle Gellar, Jennifer Coolidge, Murray Bartlett, as you mentioned, Alanis and Jerry. There are so many iconic cameos to the point where I had to do a second 10-slide carousel on Instagram, but I have a third one in me. But I feel like we might be like, to get to 30, I might have to scrape a little bit.
Just scrape in.
But I will say, if I were to do 21, the one that did not make the cut that I really tried to include was Tatum O'Neill, who I love so much, who shows up on this show. I couldn't get her in. And so maybe there will be a part 3. But anyway, I would love to know what people think about the pilot episode of Sex and the City. I hope people do go back.
I have one last question for you. How did you feel about the fashion in the pilot?
I have a note about that. Not so present. I will say I loved Miranda's silver bag that she places on the bar at Chaos. That's like my favorite fashion moment in the episode. But this was a very fashionless episode of Sex and the City. In fact, like, there are so many moments where there's like non-fashion choices being made, particularly Carrie around her apartment, because some of my favorite looks in the ensuing seasons are Carrie's idea of casual wear. So particularly when she's at home on the laptop, typing away, that's like when I sort of, you get some really out there Carrie looks that I really think are like, go on to become quintessential Carrie. But in this episode, it's a very muted color palette in general. So again, quite of its time, but I think the show smartly veers into a brighter, more playful idea of fashion and in turn New York.
I loved Charlotte's dress on her date.
Yes, and she's giving body yaddy yaddy. Well, that concludes our thoughts on the pilot episode of Sex and the City. Happy 25th anniversary, Sex and the City. Sean and I will be recapping And Just Like That, which is premiering in just a few weeks. We will be recapping it on our sister podcast, Drop Your Buffs. And it will be particularly exciting because Sean has seen now, what, 4 episodes of Sex and the City? So we're really coming at it from both sides. So I do look forward to that. I feel like fun times are to come.
Catch our recaps of And Just Like That on our Survivor podcast, Drop Your Buffs.
Yes. Yes. Now, as we stated when we announced it on our Survivor podcast, there is the Survivor connection here, which is that Sandra Oakley, who competed on season 13 of Survivor, correct?
Yes.
Finalist, right?
Well, yeah.
Finalist, Sandra Oakley, appears on an episode of Sex and the City. So for that, that is a bridge enough to, give us reason for the season to be recapping And Just Like That. So I'm really looking forward to that. I'm really looking forward to And Just Like That season 2 because I feel like I'm sort of devoid of things to make my personality at the moment. I feel like my last big moment was jury duty, and I'm looking for that next thing to hitch my wagon to. I guess at the beginning we said Joni Mitchell and Brandi Carlile is something to hitch the wagon to, but that's a one-off, right? So it's like I'm looking for something with a bit more permanence.
It's 2 nights only.
Yeah, 2 nights only. Yeah. So hopefully And Just Like That's going to give me 10 weeks of a personality.
Yeah. Okay.
Looking forward to it. When we come back, I am super duper excited for this interview. It's one I've wanted for quite a long time. She's the star of so many of my favorite movies, but chiefly among them, Waiting for Guffman, which we almost watched for today's episode, and maybe we'll visit down the line. But my God, I feel like in the canon of great Parker Posey films, obviously, Party Girl, House of Yes, Scream 3, Best in Show, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But Waiting for Guffman, I think is a bit more of considered a deep cut. I think to some people it would be like, I think Party Girl will always sort of be like her role. But anyway, she appears in this new film, Beau Is Afraid, Ari Aster's Beau Is Afraid, which is now available on video on demand. And she comes in about 2/3 of the way through the film. I'm not going to give away anything, but if you're looking for, when we say a star turn in a film, I think that like if there were a book of this, I think chapter one, but there would be a chapter dedicated to Parker Posey's performance in Beau Is Afraid. Oh, like I gave it away. I think I probably already did. And when we return, we have the truly amazing Parker Posey. Today's Shut Up, Evan is sponsored by Sunday Riley. I was going to say it's the beauty industry's best kept secret, but it's really no secret. Sunday Riley is the go-to brand for those who want great skin at a great value. I'm a huge fan of all of their products, even though my application process could use some refinement, but my current favorite of their offerings is their Good Genes Lactic Acid Treatment. Good Genes deeply exfoliates the dull surface of the skin for instant glow and radiance. As dull, dead surface cells are removed, clarity and smoothness are restored. No wonder it was listed as one of InStyle magazine's best beauty buys of 2022. Go to SundayRiley.com to check out Good Genes as well as their full range of product offerings. That's SundayRiley.com.
Shut up, Evan.
Hello, how are you today?
I'm good. How are you doing? Where are you? Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Brooklyn, New York, downtown Brooklyn.
Sweet.
I got to tell you, Parker, I've interviewed a lot of people. There are a few that I have as much regard for, both as an actor and a lover of your memoir and the way you communicated your thoughts in your book. It's a real thrill.
Thank you.
I wanted to start by asking you because I actually recently reread your memoir and there's an anecdote in your memoir that reminded me of a scene from Beau Is Afraid. So there's that sequence when his bathtub is flooded and it recalled to mind to me a memory that you share in the book when you were living in Chelsea in the 90s. And you talk about how your bathtub would overflow and it would flood into the downstairs beauty shop. Did you make that connection at all?
No, I didn't, but I should have, because plumbing issues and flooding of apartments and the bursting of pipes in like my country home upstate is a running theme in my life. But I'm a water sign, Evan. What can I tell you? I've got a lot of water going. The bath is overflowing. Yeah, I love the metaphors and the symbols in Beau Is Afraid so much. like how long it takes him to wake up. He doesn't know what time it is. All the people who come banging on his door, the graffiti outside his apartment, just the difficulties of what it can feel like just waking up and getting out your door. I think Joaquin is so funny, one of my favorite actors. So yeah, I was happy to jump in their water in that crazy movie. What did you think of it? What do you think of it?
My God, did I enjoy it. I have to tell you, Parker, this was my first Ari Aster film, bizarrely enough. So I actually saw Bo and then retroactively watched Hereditary and Midsommar.
I saw Hereditary on a plane and I've never seen images like that in my life. I've never been so affected in this way by watching a movie. And it's a horror film, but it's like, it's more than that. It's like, I think he's like Stanley Kubrick. He's really in his own, you know, he's a real auteur. He's a real storyteller. He's a fan of cinema. And so I watched that scary movie all by myself again when I got home. Some of the images of Bo is Afraid have stayed with me too. I wonder if you feel the same.
Oh, absolutely. It's funny. It took me a long time after the film to re-enter real life.
Yeah. I've heard that before.
All I wanted to do was talk to people about it, but they hadn't yet seen it because I went to an advanced screening. And I've been watching all of the press that you and your fellow actors have been doing around the film. And I imagine how hard it is to talk about this film because there is the plot of the film, but there's also the experience of the film and the emotions it evokes in all of us who see it. When I talk about Bo is Afraid, I'm kind of like, you just gotta go see it.
It's like you're encountering something that you haven't encountered before. And it elicits these feelings you don't quite know how to express. And then I go, then there's another part of my brain going, wow, how did Ari come up with the mishmash of this in creating these things for right now? Like that scene with the girls in the car when they're trying to get him to smoke pot.
Yeah.
Yeah, how scary and funny. And where are we? You know, and mean, right? Like, is this where kids are these days, you know, and how reckless and don't quite know, like, is everyone a part of Bo's imagination or, you know, so what's to tell me? Because I don't look at press. So tell me what everyone is, you tell me what everyone is saying about it, because I can tell you what, you know, Patty and I both came toward the end of production and Joaquin had been like, working for a few months. So we came at the tail end and, you know, only worked a couple of days, but you could feel that it was successful in creating this atmosphere. I came to set the day they were shooting a scene in the attic, which was, and Ari was like, I can't believe you're here on this day. I'm like, it looks great. Like. Okay.
I would say the most interesting thing I've seen is there are these like 30-minute long YouTube videos that a lot of straight white men have made, as you can imagine, like breaking down the interpretations, or rather their interpretations of the film. It's a film that people really like sort of trying to decipher. And the best part about it is that if, from what I've seen and read and heard of Ari, it's sort of up to the viewer to decide, right? Ari's not someone that seems very conclusive by way of what you should take from the material, which I think is also the true sign of an auteur in many senses, which is that like, I delivered you the goods, how you choose to consume them, that's up to you.
The timing of this is great because I think it's brought people back into theaters.
Yeah.
My scene with Bo is like, there's a lot to it. I had like three takes and the second one was just alive in this way that felt haunted and, you know, like I was in the world. So my prep to this was like, getting a body cast in Atlanta, you know, 2 hours covered in like dental mold and naked and kind of looking at my life and my body and my work. And it was a deep and funny kind of process for me this time of like, I'm not just the body, you know, I'm like, yeah, there it is. There I am. you know, I'm just there for like a second. And then, and the way that I, you know, that I exit the movie, I mean, it's such a like fine line of like annihilation and liberation at the same time, which I think acting has that quality for me. You know, if you find an opportunity where you can go into the dark cave, like go into the dark cave, you know, take that journey into that, into the unknown, and see what that's like, because you know you're going to come out the other end and you're going to be changed. I hope to write about it one day. I'm still processing it all, as you can imagine.
I hope you will, because I feel like as much as I loved your memoir, when I finished it, all I wanted was more of the memoir. So hopefully there can be a part two. I want to ask you specifically about your scene in the film and a particular line of yours, which has absolutely stayed with me and had the theater howling. After Beau climaxes, you say, I believe the line is, you burst right through the bag. Do I have the line right?
I think so.
You know, we're anticipating the fact that Beau is going to die. That's not the case, as you well know. I'm just wondering about that line. It's my favorite line.
I don't go into things thinking they're funny. And I think I learned that from the Chris Guest movies. You know, you take it very seriously.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's neat when you play, I mean, a small part, right? Then you can, there's so much you can read into it when you see it in the film and kind of with what Ari, you know, the context in which he was writing and the story that he was able to tell and the emotion behind it. I don't think I know of another director who specifically works in eliciting humor and fear and in heart, you know? So we're talking about like matters of of the heart, right? Like how open are you to go with, do you feel sorry for Beau or do you think he should grow up? You know, how do you feel about him as a hero? Do you know who Elena Ferrante is? Have you ever read the books?
Yes.
Did you read Frontimaglia?
I did not.
But Frontimaglia, if I have it correctly, it's that's kind of what I'm talking about, the feeling, particularly for women. And I think this happens as we, you know, in our puberty and as we age, of, you know, kind of the unknown territory inside that we really can't define. We really can't express, we don't have the words to express it. And that's Frontimaglia. I think artists, And Ari, certainly the filmmaker who is like, is pinpointing that kind of, that feeling. And you're not really sure. Like in the beginning when he's born, like, I mean, how did you feel when he was that first opening? Were you just...
You are immediately in it. I felt, I was almost like that feeling of being strapped into a roller coaster. That is what it evoked for me. I just had a feeling. And again, I came into it not knowing who Ari is as a director. And immediately it's like, and you know, you keep using the word auteur. I knew I was in the hands of an auteur straight away. There was just that sensibility. But you know, the great thing, Parker, is like, you know, you mentioned Christopher Guest earlier and now Ari Aster. You have been in the hands of these auteurs quite a bit throughout your career. Are you the kind of person that spends the time thinking, what is it about me that attracts all of these geniuses to someone like me?
I'm just so grateful. 25 years later, Antonio had The Staircase in mind in, you know, 2009, and it took all that time for it to come to fruition. And right at the same time that Ari got his movie together, and I'm the only choice for these guys. And that's how I've gotten cast, is that they write specifically for me, because if it was going to go through the system, I would not get the part. So that's just how it is. There's a list of other actresses that go before me. And it's always been this way of like, it has to be a strong director and they have to write for me, but they also have to fight for me in a certain way. And for me to play the part, like in Superman Returns, like Bryan Singer and those guys were like, we need someone strong for this part that can act with Kevin Spacey. And so they're like, this is Parker.
You know, you spoke in a New York Times interview earlier this year on sort of around this subject about becoming aware of just how intensely male dominated our stories are. And you said that as you matured, that's when you became more aware of it. I'm wondering when it was that you began to have that thought.
I have to say my early 30s, you know, it's been quite a while of going like, oh, just realizing like the male gaze, right? I mean, oh, well, let's put her, you know, Blade Trinity, she's going to play a vampire. And then, you know, my boyfriend at the time was like, yeah, oh, Parks, that's so hot. Like, yeah, you play a vampire. And I'm like, I don't really get it. I don't. Like when you're positioned in that and you know that there could be more to the story than just the part, you know, it seems like the men have the room to, you know, have their story, but the women are just like, they're just there for the men. I think I denied a lot of how kind of brutal it really is, you know, because you think like, oh, I have good taste and I'm, you know, I've worked really hard for, you know, not a lot of money and I really paid my dues. So, I mean, I should be able to do the same thing and continue work, but I did, that wasn't even available to me in that way. So it was kind of like, and along with my father had prostate cancer for 20 years, it was just like, I'm coming out of a time where that was kind of gut-wrenching, that, you know, where I don't know if you've been through things where your stomach is just kind of like anxious and you're suffering and there's like agony. So there was kind of like there was a good mix of things that stressed me out. And then I got to find myself in a position to like, you know, close the curtains and write a book. And so I really kind of, you know, met myself as a writer and and then I could like, oh, I can, this is kind of like acting, you know, alone or like communicating because I'm a storyteller. So it's like, oh, well, this is good to see it like this. And then I can really present and play with this as a form. And originally I was like, I'm going to write something that I could, it's kind of like theater. It's like a book of monologues. And what would this look like? So I went to small town theaters and brought myself as a cardboard cutout, as a character, and people could take pictures with the cardboard cutout. And I would teach like monologues on stage and acting class because everyone wants to be on stage right now. I've noticed that there really is not a lot of, there's not a boundary between, you know, I just did a play between like the audience and the stage. That was the idea with the book, to go out and make some kind of theater with it in these towns. Like which I'm late to the party for RuPaul's Drag Race. The small town thing that they did, which was so wonderful. And
we need you on RuPaul's Drag Race, by the way. I mean, hopefully we get you as a guest judge on a future season. Now, let me ask you this. You know, you talked about social media. I know that you have social media. You're not really active on social media. But when you were in the New York Times, that article I was speaking of, you said, quote, "To be online and have a social media presence is kind of to be your own magazine. I need to learn." I'm wondering, Parker, do you really need to learn? Like, is that something you're really interested in learning? Or is it something that you kind of recognize is not really for you? It sounds like from what you're saying, you're interested in tactile things, in being out in the world. And I feel like the basis of social media is to sort of step away from the world and view it through a prism.
Yeah, I agree with you. We're up against an algorithm. Like, I think that comes, like, I need to learn, like, how much to, you know, there's this game that Elise was playing in our play, and she's a younger person, and it happened in the city, and they were online, and just sound like an old person, but I think it was like a scavenger hunt, and then there was this ring that like lit up with like a walk sign, or, and I'm like, oh wow, people are like running around the city in like a mass scavenger hunt. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I don't, but it sounds very of the internet.
It does?
Yeah.
So I think there's something around community building.
Uh-huh.
I haven't posted on Instagram. I feel very protective because I'm nervous. I don't want to say the wrong thing, you know, because I want to be, you know, a free person, right? So I think there are things in new media to make, and I think they could be really, could bring people down to some kind of collective, I don't know, hippie train. Mm-hmm. But really, sound therapies, there's all such of like healing arts stuff that could happen in, that needs to happen in this traumatic Kafka-esque landscape that Ari Aster's Beau Is Afraid so eloquently inhabits. You like that little, how I brought that around?
Yeah, yeah, you got it right back there. Yep.
I got it, brought it right back, baby.
Yes. Now, you have one of those resumes, I need not tell you, that's chock full of beloved films. I'm wondering, when people approach you and say, I loved you in this, what is your favorite thing the this they are referring to might be?
I see my Best in Show, probably. Best in Show. I don't know, Party Girl. I think there are parts that I did like way back that I'm so glad the younger generation, like that they got it.
Uh-huh.
Because I did it with that in mind. I'm like, this is for those kids watching, you know, the TV right now. Get them up dancing. Get them up, like playing around, being stupid, being funny, and just being free. Hopefully dressing like me for Halloween. There was like a part of me, I'm like, you know, that's really what it is. Like, yeah, just like with wardrobe and stuff, sometimes I'm like, that's just like Halloween costume. Do you know about cosplay? Do you have any friends that do that?
Yeah, that go to like the conventions and the whole thing.
Yeah, that's an outlet.
So do you feel like if you were to go to a convention at like, say, the Javits Center, and you had someone dressed up like Libby May Brown from Waiting for Guffman, for instance, like that would delight you?
Yes.
I like that. You know what? I want to ask you something about Libby May Brown, because Waiting for Guffman is among my favorite of your roles.
Me too. Me too. Me too.
And there's a deleted scene that is on the DVD and I'm sure lives on the internet somewhere today. And it's your character, Libby, auditioning for Red, White, and Blaine, which is the musical chronicling the town's history. I'm wondering what you can recall of that monologue. It's such a bummer that it's not in the film.
God, Chris had 80 hours of footage. You know, he cuts for jokes. He cuts for the timing of that. And what was so fun about those movies, you don't know you're being funny when you're taking it so seriously, right? Chris is so relaxed and he's so kind and, you know, is also so funny. He just has that brain, and I just felt so comfortable with him, you know? So he called me and said, so, how is your, you need a song for, the audition, but also you can write a monologue. And I said, you know, these monologues, this is an actor. Are you an actor too?
No, I'm not, but I went to theater school. So.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
So you get these books and there's this like audition monologues for actors.
Uh-huh.
And they're just like a paragraph and everything happens in this paragraph. And so I just started talking about it. He said, well, you know, write it out and send it to me. And this was like right at the start of like email. So I just sat down and I wrote it and in like an afternoon, and I sent it to him. He's like, okay, that looks good. And then we shot it And it was the first day I'd met Bob Balaban. We were all so nervous. Catherine and Fred Willard, who were like walking around the high school auditorium, wherever we were, the classrooms. And we were really nervous. And that was fun. And I went and I just did that monologue.
Well, who's lying in a bed in an insane asylum? Plugged into a life support system? And who's wearing fine jewels and expensive clothes? And whose husband accidentally died just recently and left me all his money? Oh, this is there's a plug here that hooks into where he's breathing and stuff. Let me just take it back. And whose husband just accidentally died and left her all his money? And who's on top and who's on bottom now, huh?
Jamie Lee Curtis, his wife, really, you know, she really loved that. And she will quote that, who's on top and who's on bottom now?
Who's on top and who's on bottom now? Yeah.
Who's on top and who's on bottom now?
Well, I'm glad that the monologue was memorialized on the DVD and that it exists today and that I got to ask you about it now. Now, Parker, I often have famous fans of the guest call in to the show to ask a question. And so I want to turn it over now to the actor Matt Bomer, who has a question for you.
Hey, Parker, my name is Matt Bomer. I'm a fellow actor and a massive fan going all the way back to Dazed and Confused, Party Girl, House of Yes, Day Trippers, Henry Fool, Waiting for Guffman. The list goes on and on. You're always brilliant. And there's so many things I want to ask you, but I'm curious what it was like for you to be back on stage. I'm not sure when the last time you did theater was, but you didn't just dip your toes in. You're essentially playing, I think, a reimagining of Arkadna in The Seagull, which is one of the most iconic roles there is. So I'm curious what you learned about yourself as an actor, if you want to do more theater, and if not, what would your dream role be, or do you just wait for the perfect thing to fall on your plate? Thank you so much for all of your brilliant work, and I wish you all the best always.
That is so sweet. Thank you. Yeah, I want to direct a play now. I mean, I think playwrights have such, Thomas Bradshaw, who wrote this, is such a great writer. And I really love, like, you know, the soul of good playwriting. And so I'm curious to what is, what's out there now. I forgot how terrifying theater was. Like the Saboteur really rears its head, you know, you're like backstage and you're like, why am I doing this? We only had, I'm like, I can't, or this is so humiliating, or, you know, and then all of a sudden something else happens and you're out there and you're, you know, you're trying it and you're failing and you're finding it and you're, so we had 3 weeks to rehearse and then we had a week of tech. And then we had 3 weeks of previews, and the previews were like basically rehearsals on stage at night. And I went up the first night like 3 times and the audience loved it. You know, I called for line and and it's just like, oh yeah, this is like, this is live. This is happening. This isn't about making something perfect. This is about finding it and living it. Every performance is going to build and build and build. And, you know, you're like attached to the mother load, you know, it's like Invasion of the Body Snatchers and like,
yes,
all the wires are in your body and it's in your fluid and you're imprisoned by it. And it's not like you feel like you've done something wrong, although you can because feel like that, because there's just like some kind of like deepening or digging that just is happening because you have to do it again. You have to do it again. And so this other, like, naturally it's like, oh, I'm going to do this. That really worked last night. So, you know, let's try to have that happen again, like that kind of repetition. But then you don't take into account the audience who changes every night and their energy is so different. I would look through the cracks and sometimes I could just see like, oh, wow, this audience is still like coming out of COVID, or like I could feel like people are tired, but they're coming out to the theater. Like it's never perfect. It's really humbling. Mm. Like something is just like building inside and you don't know what makes it, you don't know what makes it a good performance, but when it flies and you're just in it and you keep building it. So your body's just moving and you're just finding it. It's so great. It's so fun.
Well, I look forward to the play that you will hopefully write that will take the New York stage by storm.
I'm not going to write a play.
Wait, are you writing or directing? Did I miss here?
I would like to direct a play.
Oh, excuse me. Sorry.
I wrote a play in college. But it was like a one act. It was like 12 pages. I'm interested in new voices. I would have put my name behind a new voice, right? Mm. Or new something that I think could be fun that people would enjoy. We'll see. I'm rambling.
No. I like it. I saw you playing earlier with your lipstick and I'm just curious what your shade of lipstick is. And is that your signature shade?
No, it's not. But Angela gave it to me when she did my press. And this is going to be so, it is Chanel Rouge. Why can't I see Rouge? It's 817.
Okay, great.
Rouge Allure.
And speaking of lipstick, I'm curious, how do you define or think about your style?
I don't know. How would you?
Well, it's kind of like what you were saying earlier about how when it comes to the costumes, right, you like lots of choices being made because the idea as you articulated it is the possibility that people could dress up as the character for Halloween. And in order to do that, the character has to have distinguishing qualities. I think about your haircut in Best in Show, for instance, as like hyper specific, right? And so your style, similarly, I mean, I'm looking at your neck right now and that cut of the shirt you're wearing and the choice to wear pink tinted sunglasses indoors, which I love, by the way. So I would say that I think of your style as hyper specific.
I like that.
But how do you think about it?
I think style is fun. I think it's a conversation in a way. I'm into comfortable ankle boots, or I stomp around, so I want to be able to. I like shoes that can be, you know, worn a lot. I'm kind of a hippie, really. But then I like to dress up too and have that kind of fun. Yeah, God, you know, women and their style. And you think of like the last 100 years of style and fashion and where we're at now, or design. A lot of new arts coming alive here.
I even think about what you were saying earlier about sort of like that lack of appreciation for auteurs. I feel similarly in the world of fashion. I mean, I think about figures like Isaac Mizrahi or Zac Posen, who no longer have their namesake lines. And it's like, these are two of the most incredible artisans that exist in the world of fashion. And there just was a lack of appreciation for the work.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's not the age of enlightenment.
No, it's not.
There's not a renaissance happening now. They're such talents and I know they'll find another place. You know, I didn't, in my 40s, I was working with, you know, Woody Allen and Louis C.K. and a few other directors, and I ran out of money. I wasn't getting paid enough. I had to sell my apartment. The discrepancy and the lack of support. But then you go like, whoa, this is a path, right? This is a path. So perseverance, you know, keep making, keep doing. They're both creative people. And I know that they'll just be directed in some other way. I saw Isaac not too long ago, who's in a play right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just keep the shimmy on, you know, keep moving
through the tunnel.
I forgot your question.
Just talking about we led into the conversation about sort of the lack of appreciation of artisans, but it began with you defining your style. But the sense I get from you, Parker, tell me if I'm wrong, you're not someone that's overly interested in like talking about yourself so much as you have a curiosity about others, it seems.
Oh my God, yes. Yes, I want to listen to you. I'm a good, like, if we were dancing, I want to follow you.
Uh-huh.
So I could, like, you know, lose myself to song or, you know, I just, it's why I love New York so much is that I you go out the door and you're just curious, right? You don't know what's going to happen outside, but then I could see the same thing about being in the country too and in nature. Yeah, I'm about to go to LA in a few weeks. So we'll see what California's like. But I do like that. I love that connectedness. Someone was telling me about Bjork's new album is all about the mycelium network.
Yes.
And I'm so up that alley. I read that book, How to Change Your Mind by Michael Pollan. If I could be in any other like business or like world, the healing arts and what they're discovering with the neural pathways of our brains and depression and alternative and therapies and individualized medicine, I'm very excited and inspired by. So these things, I think there's so much room for what the filmmakers and what actors and TV and streaming and all that, there's so much room for more, for new forms to help. And not just like in a like commercial way, but in a way that, calms us down. And I think podcasts are doing that. I think what you're doing is helping with, you know, openness and communication. And so, yeah, thank you.
Well, thank you. I want to articulate, if this is the last time I ever get the opportunity to chat with you, you mentioned earlier how you're not someone who's like online, you're not reading the reviews and whatnot. I want you to know, and for whatever it's worth, that the internet collectively really, really loves you. You are very, very, very beloved. When I even saw that I had the opportunity to chat with you, like it shifted something inside of me, the mere thought of it, just because you're someone who people are so interested in both as a performer and then also like as a thinker. And you've proven it in the last hour, you aren't sort of bending and conforming the way society constricts us so much these days. I come back to those gorgeous pink glasses and the Chanel lip, and like you just are constantly making choices in the world and in your work. And I think that's admirable. And I want you to know that the pockets of the internet that I'm on, you are like that top tier.
That is so sweet and good to hear. And I'm so glad. I have to say when Gracie passed and I was posting about that and the messages I got from people who were following me meant so much to me. And that there are, as the little amount that I did, like I had to do with animals and you know, there was a sweetness. And I do believe in that collective cohesion of goodness. And so that and your proof of that for telling me that.
And someone even mentioned to me that they were in like a dog park once and their dog came up and like sat on your lap by accident and they were super apologetic and you were like, no. Like you were so excited to have this dog in front of you. So even the anecdotes I hear of people encountering you around the city, I just want you to know that, like, so whether you are directing next or you write a follow-up to your last memoir, whatever, there is a rabid audience of people that want you and whatever, wherever life takes you, there are a lot of us that are going to follow.
Can I tell you a quick story, a dog story about what's the Key Peele?
Key and Peele.
I had just seen their show and I was at Sid Gold's. I don't know if you've been to Sid Gold's piano bar in Chelsea that Joe McGinty has. Mm-hmm. And so he was there and I was like, oh my God, I have to see him and I have to tell him how much I love that show, especially that their airplane one, the episode they did when they're on an airplane just made me laugh so hard. So I went up to him and I said, I just want to introduce myself.
tell you what a fan I am of your show and that particular episode. He goes, oh yeah, well we've met already. And I was like, I always go like, uh-oh, like, well, I'm like, oh really? And he's like, yes, you were at Washington Square Dog Run and you asked me to watch your dog as you went to get coffee and you asked me if I wanted one.
Wow.
I'm small town.
Uh-huh.
I'm small town, and I treat New York like a small town. And it really can be a small town. Like, you may run into me next week very easily.
I hope.
And yeah, I hope so too.
Parker, thank you so much.
Shut up, Evan. Shut up, Evan. Shut up, Evan.
Shut Up, Evan is produced by me, Evan Ross Katz, with audio editing by Sophia Asmuth and social media by Griffin Dunn. Shout out to our Patreon subscribers for their financial support, and thank you to you all, the listeners, for helping us keep the lights on.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.